From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we review election results around the state from a new Detroit mayor.
This has been a campaign of unity, and it will be an administration of unity.
To marijuana, cities merging, and gay rights.
What's on the mind of people in Michigan is economics, is jobs, 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 and they're not as interested in other people's sexual practices or their recreational practices, whatever they are.
Michigan singer-songwriter Stuart Frankie takes us inside his battle with leukemia.
Everything changed from my songwriting to my lifestyle to my diet to my, you know, my vocabulary.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. So glad you're with us today. On today's show, we will look at key election results from around the state, marijuana, gay rights, and how did you vote, and what's the takeaway from election 2013? Then, later in the hour, we talk with Michigan singer-songwriter Stuart Frankie. He will take us inside his battle with leukemia. But first, well, it's been quite a journey for a candidate who got booted off the primary ballot, was going to fold his tent and walk away, and then was urged to mount a write-in campaign. He swept the primary, and today he is the new mayor-elect of Detroit. Mike Duggan to become Detroit's first white mayor in 40 years, beating Wayne County Sheriff Benny Napoleon. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick has covered the Duggan campaign, and she was at the victory party last night. So, Sarah, what did the mayor-elect have to say?
The message that we heard from Mike Duggan was that basically one of unity, and that he has built up really quite an impressive group of grassroots collaborators in the clergy, in various neighborhood organizations, and that's something that he's going to continue to use going forward, and that he's said, as he said before, that this is a new Detroit where it doesn't matter if you're black, brown, or white, it doesn't matter if you're gay or straight, that this is a Detroit that should be for everyone.
So what did you hear from supporters at his party, Sarah? Do you think there are now enough Detroiters willing to stop thinking of things as white or black and move towards who or what works best for the city?
Well, I think certainly amongst his supporters, that is the case. It is pretty noticeable in some ways that the people who supported him are obviously a substantial number of people in the city of Detroit, but also throughout Metro Detroit, throughout the business community, throughout in any number of groups throughout Metro Detroit. So it's he is kind of a character that not only breaks the racial divide, but also sort of this divide that had been set up between Detroit and the suburbs, the sort of 8-mile dividing line. So
Right. Apparently
enough Detroiters at this point are willing to sort of forego that mindset and embrace this new reality that he represents.
And of course, here we have a newly elected mayor taking power in a city with an emergency manager who has certainly been running the show. What did Mike Duggan say about how he plans to work with Kevin Orr and, of course, in turn, Governor Snyder?
Well, all along, Mike Duggan has said, I oppose the emergency manager, but at the same time, he's here, this is the law, and I'm going to work with him. And he said, work with him very aggressively and he talked about building relationships with the emergency manager, with Governor Snyder, with legislators in Lansing. So he is going to, even though he will have sort of very little real power to start with, he's going to be starting to build the foundation for moving forward for when Kevin Orr does leave, which will probably be sometime late next year.
And have we had any indication even throughout the campaign or even today from Kevin Orr as to what he sees as his relationship with the mayor-elect?
Well, Kevin Orr did send out a message of congratulations immediately after Duggan was elected last night and said he looks forward to working with him on the continued transformation of Detroit.
Typical, expected.
Yes, a pretty generic statement, but did say that he would Duggan would sit down with his office within the next few days and start sort of trying to figure things out. There's been a lot of talk around town that Kevin Orr has possibly been trying to take on too much in City Hall in terms of taking on not just trying to fix the city's finances and get it into bankruptcy, but also sort of run things on the day-to-day level, which initially he said that he would leave that to the elected officials. That didn't really happen.
Right.
But it'll be interesting to see whether he sort of backs off and lets Duggan take much more sort of leadership on those things while he's still around, or whether things will sort of continue as they have been with Kevin Orr really running the whole show.
Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody joins us now. Well, Steve, marijuana was on the ballot in Lansing, Jackson, and Ferndale, and voters in all three cities said yes to pot, yeah?
Yes, voters in all three, more than 60% of the voters, gave their approval for decriminalizing possession of 1 ounce or less of marijuana by a person over 21 on private property.
Just to make sure, we're talking about small amounts and we're talking about possession, not sale.
No. And if you're thinking of lighting up, it's probably not a good idea to do. State and federal marijuana laws will still be in effect in Ferndale, Jackson, Lansing, and the other 11 communities where voters have approved similar ordinances. So if you light up, you can still get arrested. But, the local ordinances and Michigan's marijuana law are creating some confusion for local police departments, which have to decide which to enforce and which not to enforce. So the result is most police departments in these communities are simply ignoring these local decriminalization ordinances.
What do you mean by ignoring?
Well, most police departments aren't going out of their way to bust people for these small amounts of marijuana anyway. Usually what you'll see when someone's charged with these, that there are other crimes they're also being charged with. So this becomes more of an add-on charge as opposed to a primary offense.
Now, it's kind of seen as a big loss. One of the losers of the day were the anti-pot advocates. And it's interesting, even conservative Jackson said yes. And these really passed by flying colors, didn't they?
Yes, it passed by, in Jackson, the birthplace of the Republican Party, passed the marijuana ordinance by well over 60% of the voters. But as you said, we do still have opponents like Attorney General Bill Schuette, who's against any decriminalization efforts. And there was a recent poll that showed 31% of Michigan voters want marijuana possession punished, not legalized.
All right. So it's not a total wash, if you will. But are there signs that the state legislature might be willing to entertain those looks that are being asked for at changing marijuana laws on a statewide level?
Well, there is a bill right now before the State House Judiciary Committee that would basically do the same thing that the proposals passed in Lansing, Ferndale, and Jackson last night would do, basically decriminalizing possession of less than an ounce of marijuana. The bill has the support of a small group of Democrats and Republican state lawmakers, but I don't know if it has enough support to get the bill out of committee.
And so the pro-marijuana campaign have to be feeling very good about what happened last night. And I would guess they're ready to bring it down to a ballot referendum if that's what it takes.
They're getting close. When I talked with the people behind this effort, they say the poll numbers are really close for them to being ready to move forward with this. They want to give the legislature time to work on this bill. And if it passes before the end of 2014, I think they'll be good with that. If the legislature doesn't act to decriminalize marijuana by the end of next year, I think you can definitely look for a statewide referendum in 2016.
Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you.
We turn now to the west side of the state, and that's where Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith's been following a ballot proposal that called for the merger of Saugatuck and Douglas, two smaller cities just south of Holland. And Lindsay, it seems voters felt two cities are better than one?
Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty, I would say, overwhelming vote. You have 60% really majority that is voting in favor of keeping two cities instead of one, so yes.
What were some of the reasons and the arguments in favor of merging?
Well, it started off as a cost savings proposal. I should say the very first time this was floated, it included Saugatuck Township. So it would have been a three for one instead of a two for one. Through the process that the state does these consolidations, they determined that the township really wasn't suitable for a merger, but that the cities were potentially a good fit for one another. As the arguments sort of went along, it seemed that the cost savings were a lot less than originally proposed with the township. So then it kind of got into, well, you're going to lose this staffer and I want this staffer. And sort of, is this cost savings really worth it? Because at that point, it was about $467,000 a year. One study that everybody seems to agree about the numbers said. then it got into more broader vision. What do we want to do with this harbor? It's kind of hard to do things when you have to have two separate cities approve everything. But at the same time, they are two separate cities, and it gets into the point where, well, I like my city council, and would there be four of my representatives or three of my representatives? And I think ultimately the money savings they decided weren't really worth it.
It's kind of interesting, isn't it? This vote comes at a time when there's a lot of conversation in our state about streamlining and regional authorities and merging school districts. And you have to wonder, is this vote a sign that voters are not particularly inclined to want to give up their local identities?
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously a big conversation. Sharing services seems to be taking off, where cities or school districts maybe work together and contract out for a bigger bid for, say, food services for school districts or something like that. There was an expert that I talked to for a feature that I did about this that really brought home, I think, the main point was the only time these really seem to work is if both communities or school districts that are involved in a potential merger are so bad off that they really need to combine to survive, or you have some sort of broader, huge vision to, say, transform it into a brand new community city that can grow and really take off. They see it as a launching pad. And in that respect, they're not really saving costs. You're turning really into a bigger community. And he seems to think that that's really where it works out, where people say yes.
And finally, what happened with the park millage vote in Grand Rapids?
Ah, yes, my hometown here. The parks millage. So this really is, some people here certainly paint this as a sign of less state investment in cities, state money, revenue sharing dollars we're talking. So the city of Grand Rapids has cut its parks department more than any other department. So, the city parks that were built, 50, 60 years ago are really in not terribly great shape. This is really going to be a dedicated millage to raise over the next 7 years millions of dollars to reinvest in these parks.
There you go. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith reporting from West Michigan. Thanks, Lindsay.
Thanks, Cindy.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. So we got updates and heard results from our Michigan Radio reporter team. Let's turn now for some perspective on what these results mean for Michigan. Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst, joins us now. Hello, Jack.
Nice to be here.
So let's start with Detroit. What do the results tell you about where Detroit voters are right now?
Well, what it says is Detroit voters are desperate for something better. They want somebody who will make the police come in under an hour when you get murdered, and they want someone who will get the streetlights turned back on and give the city sort of functioning again post-emergency manager. And clearly, they felt that Mr. Duggan, a man who has sort of a record as a turnaround artist with a number of agencies, the Detroit Medical Center, as you mentioned, but also Wayne County's budget and the suburban bus system, they are betting on Mr. Duggan to have a better chance of doing that.
As we know, as things stand now, we've watched since Kevin Orr has ridden into town. Mike Duggan, as mayor, has very little power under Kevin Orr. How do you see Mike Duggan using his position?
Well, obviously, everybody involved is going to want a smooth transition. Now, the new city council that was just elected can fire Kevin Orr any time after, I believe, the end of September of next year. So, obviously, they want something as seamless as possible, and I think it's very likely that there will be hopefully a good working relationship between Duggan, the new city council, and Orr. Duggan has said what he would like is if he ran the city day to day and Orr was content with handling the debt. Well, I'm not quite sure the emergency manager is going to be willing to limit himself to that, but certainly I don't think it's going to be a case where the mayor and the council are totally ignored. So these are all uncharted waters. A city this size has never been through bankruptcy before. Detroit's never had an election under an emergency manager before. So we simply, a lot of this is conjecture.
And I have seen some things written even today, post-election, that, Orr has a monster heaping plate in front of him, and that with all of the complicated bankruptcy work he needs to do, he might be happy to turn over the management part to someone like a Mike Duggan.
Well, Well, it's not that simple because everything is interconnected, and how much money the city has and what the city can spend is also going to be tied to bankruptcy. We simply don't know what the bankruptcy judge is going to do. We don't know what's going to become of pensions. My guess is that Duggan would like Orr to be responsible for and be blamed for a lot of the really unpleasant decisions, slashing or eliminating people's pensions among them. He would rather hang that on the emergency manager. I think there's a little bit of disingenuousness on his part where Duggan says the city didn't need an emergency manager and he wishes there wasn't one. In some ways, an emergency manager is sort of a present for whatever mayor would have been elected because that means they get to blame the hard decisions that would have had to be made on someone else.
I've got to get your thoughts on this. You know, we've seen time and time again how easy it is to make promises on the campaign trail, and then it's another thing altogether once you're sitting behind the desk and you're coping with this messy process we call democracy. Do you think it might be wise now that he's elected for Mike Duggan to lower expectations?
Well, I think that expectations are pretty minimal, and I don't know how he could lower them any further. People want city services to basically work better than they are now, and I think that he doesn't dare not deliver on that to the best of his ability. The city is in an almost unbelievably dreadful state, and what he needs to be thinking about, and we don't talk a lot about this, is what happens after bankruptcy, because eventually the bankruptcy process everybody thinks will be done by the end of next year, by the time the emergency manager leaves, and then what? You've got you still have a poor city, shorn of debt maybe, but also probably shorn of some of the assets it now still has. How does that city function, provide services, and stay solvent? Because the city emerging from bankruptcy is not going to have a line of credit anyplace. It's not going to be able to get any money, and the government, certainly the state government, isn't inclined to do anything, especially for Detroit. Duggan has to figure out how to make that work.
I want to turn our focus from Detroit's mayoral race, Jack, and look at some of the implications from the ballot proposals that we saw across the state. And in your commentary this morning, you were saying the results of these proposals have a common theme and a common mood. What did you mean by that?
I think that you look at these, and most of the time local elections don't. They're all over the lot. But people don't like government very much, but they are willing to spend money to fix up roads. Usually where you have local area, I mentioned in my little suburb, by almost a 10-to-1 margin, people voted to tax themselves more to fix the streets. And there are other street referendums that passed sort of in communities all around Michigan. People were willing to renew school millages most of the time, one exception being Farmington. Sometimes they were even in favor of new money for schools, but they didn't want to spend for other government entities. They want change, but they don't want any real radical change, and they're not very interested anymore in social issues. There's a much more an attitude of tolerance. Of course, the big story was Royal Oak. Royal Oak is sort of a classic Leave It to Beaver suburb. It used to have about 90,000 people. It has a little under 60,000 now. But 12 years ago, they had a human rights ordinance on the ballot that said you can't discriminate against people for sexual orientation or gender identity. And it overwhelmingly was defeated by almost a 70-30 margin. Yesterday, it passed with 54%. If you look at the precinct results in detail, which I've done, the precincts that tend to vote Republican in Royal Oak, the sort of northeast side, voted against this referendum. The more Democratic precincts voted for it. There are more of those folks, however. But overall, you have it within 12 years going from 30% of the people supporting this to 54%. It really indicates, it's really a measure, I think, of how attitudes have changed. The other very interesting thing to me was these marijuana ordinances.
Yes.
Saying they're decriminalizing people caught with a small amount of marijuana. And so you have gay-friendly Ferndale, sort of a hipster kind of place. You've got working-class Jackson, and you've got Lansing, the government and political and university center. They all had these referenda, and they all voted in favor of decriminalizing small amounts of marijuana by almost identical margins in the sort of low 60% range, which tells me that people say, look, we've got enough problems. We don't need the police running around after people who may have a joint on them. But we're not talking about big deal pushers. We're talking about people who use a small amount of recreational marijuana. And I think people right now, what's on the mind of people in Michigan is economics, is jobs, 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 and education. And they're not as interested in other people's sexual practices or their recreational practices, whatever they are.
Let's just take, if we can, a takeaway from all of these results. Come November 2014, Jack, what do you think lawmakers and certainly the campaign managers who have their eye on that election, what should they take away from what happened yesterday?
I think they're taking away that people sort of expect results. The people, certainly, especially in Detroit, but people understand that the old ways aren't working. They're not willing at this point to embrace radical solutions, but they're not interested anymore in rhetoric either. They want people concentrating on sort of the main event and to keep their eye on the ball. And I would think the legislature has been very, very reluctant to do anything to repair the roads. All sorts of people, not just the governor, all sorts of experts have said if we don't start spending $1 billion a year on the roads now, we're eventually going to have to spend $2.5 billion a year if we let them deteriorate even further. And they're very afraid of doing that. But what I look at in these elections is that people aren't willing to raise their taxes generally, but if they can see what they're getting for them, and there's no place or it's probably easier to do that than on road construction repair, that I think people will be very friendly to lawmakers who, or at least to be very tolerant of lawmakers who say, look, we've got to pay more money so your axle won't break in half.
Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst. As always, a pleasure. Thank you, Jack.
My pleasure, Cindy.
There's an intriguing movie premiere happening tomorrow night in Detroit. The subject, beer. The Michigan Beer Film will be screened at the Fillmore Theater, and along with that will be samples of some of the Michigan brews that are featured in the film. Well, we are always happy to talk about Michigan beer here on Stateside, so we welcome the producer and director of the Michigan Beer Film, Kevin Romeo. Kevin joins us from Kalamazoo. Welcome, Kevin.
Thanks, Cindy.
So tell us, what are you saying in your film about the craft beer scene in Michigan?
You know, as we kind of went along the process, one of the big things that we really started gravitating towards was just the fact that we want people to kind of understand how much goes into the process and that the beer they drink can be a very labor-intensive process and a very capital-intensive process, and a lot of thought and design and intentionality goes into the things that they can buy at the bar. And so instead of maybe just without a lot of thought picking the beer that you're comfortable with, maybe consider a beer made by someone locally that put a lot of effort and time and artistry into what you could take part of by buying a beer from them. Definitely felt like a blue collar, almost like a blue collar attitude toward the whole thing. I think a lot of people think that making beer is just fun and sexy, but mm-hmm. in reality, it's really messy. It's really wet, and it's just a lot of heavy lifting at times. And so I think it's exciting because Michigan, you know, it's been down, and people talk about Michigan around the country like we're this place that's just drying up. But honestly, the brewing industry is really leading a charge in this direction of authenticity and innovation and just creation and community, you know. So it's really awesome.
So it's kind of everything old is new again. It's kind of a hearkening back to some kind of old-fashioned values, right?
I would definitely say that. A common theme we had that we kind of you'll see in the film is that back in, you know, centuries ago in Europe, they realized that the pub was the center of the community where people get together and talk about their problems and talk about their lives and have a drink together or two and be together and learn about your fellow human being.
Right.
And, you know, when it moved to big companies advertising on Super Bowl Sunday, we lost that a bit. And a bar is a bar is a bar to a lot of people. So it's pretty cool that the local pub, the brewery, could kind of reinvigorate that part of our communities. And everyone wants to be part of a thriving community these days. And we're all kind of tired of box stores and food shipped to us from hundreds of miles away. So this all ties very much into like a local food movement. So, yeah.
As you shot your documentary, the Michigan Beer Film, and got to really see the inner workings of Michigan's craft beer industry, why do you think Michigan has moved up to fifth place in the nation in the number of craft breweries? What do you think has driven the interest in, and growth in craft beer in our state?
I think there's a variety of factors, and I think some of the factors are people are literally out of options, and it's a thing that they can get into. One of the breweries, the brewery that we focus on the most in the film is a brewery named Greenbush,
mm-hmm.
and they're down by on the edge of the state going into Indiana. Their story basically started with the owner, Scott, hurting himself in a construction kind of accident, and he was a very smart man, and he's always been into cooking, but he had bounced around a few different jobs, not really feeling like any of those jobs were his calling, and he basically cut his finger, almost lost his finger, and it was out of work for 6 weeks. In that time, he essentially had to declare bankruptcy with his family because they were so low on funds anyway, and then he couldn't work. But he was brewing beer in the meantime while he was out of work. And in that time, he put everything he had into it, and it's exploded. And now they're exponentially growing by the month, it seems like, at Greenbush. And that's just really exciting. And so that it's like this thing that says, you know, we don't have a lot of options around here, and we're making our own options. You know, it's like making your own stuff happen rather than waiting for life to happen to you. I also think that a big reason Michigan's craft beer scene is exploding is that we have Larry Bell, who obviously started Bell's Brewing and really was a pioneer in the Midwest for craft beer. And you can't help but notice that all these breweries point back to Larry Bell for why they got into craft beer in the first place. And then also just, you know, we're surrounded by fresh water. Joe Short, owner of Short's Brewing Company, points that out during the film. And there's just a great amount of reasons. And those, I would say those are three quick ones.
Do you find, as you talk to craft brewers around Michigan, is there a pretty good sense of, is it collegiality and community, maybe more than competition?
Yeah, I would definitely say, and that's another thing we kind of go through in the film. But, yes, there has been great camaraderie and great collaboration in the past, and there still is for the most part with a lot of the breweries. There does seem to be some breweries popping up pretty quickly, pretty rapidly, that maybe aren't as interested in the community element of it or the collaboration. But I know for a fact, you know, the guys at Arbor Brewing Co., Matt and Renee, Matt said that he's great friends with Aaron Morse of Dark Horse Brewing, and he said there's been times where we needed something, and Aaron was just so generous to offer up some of his guys to help with a project, and vice versa, and things like that happen a lot. But I do think that as the number grows, it gets harder and harder to help each other out because the demand is so high. Everyone's busy working on their own projects. That's tough to be involved with everyone else's stuff, too. So I think the spirit's still there, but it's getting harder and harder to be in a collaborative way as much as it used to be. But they're definitely still there.
Which leads one to wonder, can there be too much of a good thing? Could there wind up being too many craft brewers in Michigan, do you think?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, everything's going to have a breaking point. That's a big hot topic right now with beer in our state. Just like any commodity or any item that is bought and sold in any industry, beer can get burnt out on people if there's so many offerings. And one of the really unique things that I heard throughout the course of the filming was a really great insight on the thing was by a guy named Michael Kaiser that we interviewed. And he said, craft beer stores are trying as hard as they can to find more and more space for the beers coming at them and trying to make room, but they're starting to curate their when curation is part of the solution, that means that people are being left out. And that's where the competitive element comes in, because you've got to be able to keep up. And there's brewers that are making great beer with great labels, with great vision, with a great business. And if you don't have all those things, then you might not survive the next 10 years, because on top of all that, the beer fans that are out there right now are very discerning, and they're very capable of knowing what's good and what isn't, where maybe 10 or 15 years ago, people might try a craft beer and just go, oh, that was okay. I can't, you know, I don't really know what that's even supposed to taste like. But now a lot of people know what it's supposed to taste like. And if it doesn't line up with what you understand about beer and essentially just tastes good, then it's not going to last. So
Kevin Romeo's documentary, The Michigan Beer Film, premieres tomorrow night at the Fillmore Detroit. The doors will open at 5:30, and tickets are available at the door. And as we mentioned, you will be able to sample some of the brews featured in the film. And Kevin joined us from Kalamazoo. Thanks so much, Kevin.
Thank you, Cindy. Have a good day.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Whenever you talk about the key players in Michigan's music scene, one of the names that inevitably comes up is that of Stuart Frankie. Born in Saginaw, he's made his home, raised his family, and built his music career in Metro Detroit. Writer and critic Jim McFarlane calls Stuart Frankie Detroit's working man's troubadour. And it's a title that he's earned and maintained over decades of making his music.
Hey man, how are you? It's good to see your lonely smile.
But today we're going to hear about another journey Stuart Frankie has been on. A journey into the world of cancer, a journey that started when he was diagnosed with leukemia, and it forced Stu and his family and circle of friends to join together to wage what became a ferocious battle. And he's telling the story of that battle in a new ebook, and the title says it all, What Don't Kill Me Just Makes Me Strong. Stuart Frankie, welcome to Stateside.
Cynthia, how are you?
It's good to see you, and I'm sure you hear that time and time again all these years after you won your battle.
Better to be seen than viewed.
That's
yes.
Absolutely true. Set the stage for us, Stu. What was life like before your diagnosis? You married, two small kids?
Yeah, I was married, children that were 2 and 4. And things were going well. My career was on the upswing. Everything was going really well. I was 37, 38 years old prior to it, and everything was going well. Music career was going well. I was playing a lot of shows. I was making my third record at the time. And I made a record called House of Lights, which is a metaphor for the fragile beauty of family life. And that's what it was. It was sort of a halcyon period.
Boy.
And when I was 39, I was diagnosed, and everything changes overnight, as most cancer patients know. It mm-hmm. just goes from one life to another like that.
In the course of a few words from a physician.
Exactly.
You have been writing music and making music since you were a teenager. You were a little bit of a late bloomer in that you didn't release your first CD for the public until you were like 34. But you'd been writing and expressing yourself through your music. So you've got that lifelong habit of turning experiences and observations into songs. How did that skill set serve you for recounting this battle in your book?
It was funny. A good friend of mine is the critic Dave Marsh, and he said, I want to hear what you're going to do after this, which gave me a sense of hope, you know, after the transplant, and how profound it would be and how it would affect my music. And it really did. It really affected my music in a narrative sense, made it more soulful, made it more more human, less about storytelling,
okay.
more
maybe less in your head and more from your
less
heart?
In my head and more from my heart, exactly, and more about others. And because that's the biggest lesson I learned, was that we're how dependent we are upon each other, even in our anonymity. We're just profoundly dependent upon each other, even when we don't know it, you know. And so that came across in the songwriting, and it really, everything changed from my songwriting to my lifestyle, to my diet, to my my vocabulary.
You know, one might have thought, because of your songwriting and your life of songwriting, that you might have taken this story of your cancer battle and told it through a CD. Why a book?
Well, I was always a writer. I was a writer at the Metro Times for 10 years. I wrote a column and essays and criticism there, mostly music and film. And so I'd wanted to write a book because it was twofold. Mm-hmm. Number one is I wanted it to be sort of not a primer or anything, but a guide for people who are newly diagnosed. I wanted it to be of help to other people, first of all and foremost. And second of all, I wanted it to be cathartic in the sense that I could wrap up that period of my life, and I could do that and do that succinctly. And songs are open-ended. There's no point. There's no exclamation point or period to them. Mm-hmm. They're open ended, and they're open to the what would be the word to the analysis of the listener.
Or the interpretation.
The interpretation of the listener.
Sure, okay.
Better. Yeah. So, and a book is more emphatic, and there it is, and it begins and it ends, and the time period begins and it ends.
There you go. Well, I'd like to ask you to read from your book, What Don't Kill Me Just Makes Me Strong. This was actually in March of 1998, and you were out with friends skiing in Aspen.
Physically, I didn't feel like myself on this trip. I got very cold skiing and became winded easily. And my legs were like jello, an unfamiliar feeling for me as I'd been athletic most of my life, earning a scholarship to college, and even playing a European ATP satellite tennis tour in 1980. The next to last afternoon before I left, I stopped mid-mountain, puked my guts out without warning, and had to sit in the snow for quite a while just to make it back down the mountain. Later that spring, while stretching to go running in May of 98, I felt an oblong, doughy lump on the left side of my stomach just beneath my rib cage. When I took a breath, it would move up and down, in and out from under my ribs. I wasn't alarmed. I thought it was part of my stomach that I could feel now that I'd lost some weight. I was pleased with the weight loss. In the music world, images, for better or worse, are a large part of the deal. Spring became early summer. Over Memorial Day weekend, I told Julia that I just didn't feel right, that I felt tired in an odd way, and I noticed that my tongue was coated with this thick, lead-colored crap. My upper lip line had also somehow lost its bowed definition, and my fingernails were clubbed, raised, and lined in a vertical prominence. I was set to go play my weekly tennis match with my friend and basketball legend Joe Dumars, something I looked forward to and loved doing, and had to call him and beg off. Just no vitality, I told Joe. Now, a little worried and wondering about the croissant-shaped lump in my gut, I went to a walk-in clinic at Beaumont Hospital in Royal Oak, the hospital where my children were born. It was a Friday in June. I recall I was wearing all black that day, the de rigueur uniform for a rock and roller or a grave digger. The resident physician who saw me was young and very direct. He examined the abdominal lump and drew some blood and ran a full CBC. I'd been so healthy my entire life, I'd never even had my blood drawn. I waited about an hour, and he came back looking a little older, pale and drained. "Your white blood cell count is 128,000, he said. "What's that mean?" I asked. I knew very little of anatomy and concerned myself with my own health remotely. Like a lot of us in the healthy world, I took it for granted. "Well, normal is around 4,000 to 5,000. Something's very wrong, but I'm not exactly sure what. It could be an aberrant infection. However, it's likely leukemia or lymphoma. Your blood might be viscous. The lump in your abdomen is actually your spleen, bloated with red blood cells." "This can't be right," I said, stunned. "Could the blood test be wrong?" "Well, we'll order a bone marrow biopsy for Monday," he said. "Those results are the absolute, the gold standard in telling us what's going on. Call this number and your biopsy will be scheduled for Monday morning." Then he quickly broke eye contact, dropped his head, handed the paper with the numbers, and dismissed me with the detached compassion touching my knee. I couldn't tell whether he was used to handing out bad news or not. The phrase gold standard was hopeful. It seemed to suggest that there was some doubt to his diagnosis and maybe more to uncover. What I could tell by the way he treated me was that something had changed. I had definitely entered the world of the afflicted and could sense I was in big trouble.
That's Detroit singer-songwriter and now author Stuart Frankie reading from his memoir, What Don't Kill Me Makes Me Strong. And ultimately, yes, you had leukemia, and you found out your best option was a bone marrow transplant. You were pretty fortunate because your sister was a match.
Very fortunate.
Because, you know, we've seen the story. Remember J.P. McCarthy?
Right.
Legendary Detroit disc jockey.
He
was adopted and couldn't find a match.
Couldn't find a match. He had, I think, aplastic anemia.
Yeah.
And they've made great strides with unmatched bone marrow donors. So,
but having a match,
really a genetic match, because you're a perfect match.
You've got enough going against you when you're trying to do this.
Right.
And you wound up on 10 Green. That was your new home on the bone marrow transplant unit at Harper Hospital. You had a physician from the Karmanis Cancer Center guiding your treatment. Tell us about that treatment.
Well, you go in, and what they need to do, since it's the cancer is in your marrow, is they have to kill your marrow, which involves killing your immune system, because your marrow contains your white blood cells, red blood cells, platelets, and hemoglobin. So they kill it completely with with chemotherapy, high-dose chemotherapy. So you go down and you literally have no counts. You're as close to dead as you can be. And then after about 10 days of that, they engraft you with, in my case, my sister's marrow. It's just a little bag. It sounds like a big deal, but they just bring a bag in. It looks like little pink stuff, and it's a little baggy, and it goes into your center line, which goes into your heart. And the marrow goes in, and it starts to engraft, and it's miraculous. It's on that angle that it goes in, and it begins to
grow.
I grow and identify your own organs, even though there's something called graft versus host disease, where it doesn't identify all your organs. Mm-hmm. But you just feel, it's hard to describe how terrible you feel for how long. Because,
well, you do it in your book very, very well, between the chemotherapy of side effects, which I think we all got a sense it can be a very hard journey. You really did give us a sense of what it was like to kind of be there in your room with you during that process.
Well, I just wanted to tell the truth as close as I could and remember as much as I could without scaring prospective patients.
Well, you had a visitor.
I did.
A woman, a strange woman walks in, and you're like, who are you? Are you bringing germs in? Why are you here to see me? Tell us about that visit.
I was very wary of people coming in because you don't know. A cold or flu could kill you. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden I was sitting with my sister just talking one day, and in walks a person unannounced or anything, no knocking, no nothing. And it really made me nervous. And she walked over and she actually sat on my bed. It really made me nervous. And she just said, she was a hairdresser, and I don't remember her name. I don't remember where she was from or anything. She just said, I've been through what you're going through, and you're going to be fine. And it was very inspirational at that point.
And she had been in your room, hadn't she?
Yeah, she had been in my room. We had shared that room. And now I do that. I go back often and go into rooms, and because it's the best thing you can do. There's no words I can say. I can just say, I was as sick as you are, and now I'm back to where I was, if not better. And so it's the best thing you can do for patients at this point. They're better than words, better than anything, is just show up and say, hey, I'm here. You can make it too.
You went through so much terrible pain and side effects from the chemo and all the necessary evil to accomplish what you needed to save your life. But I'm wondering, Sue, did you get to any brink of saying, you know what, forget it. I'm out. I'm going to leave this in God's hands.
There's a certain amount of surrender that you need to fight on. And my wife said at one point, why don't you just give it up, which means a very different thing than give up. She said, just give it up to whatever you believe in. And there is a bit of a spiritual battle in my book about, I'm not sure about things. I'm not sure about the presence of God or, the distinct aspects of God's representation. And I did that, and that really helped. I did give it up, just let it go. And there was only so much I could control, and it was very little what I could control.
But you didn't give up.
But I didn't give up. Big difference. I gave it up to the whatever, to the spirit, to nature, to whatever you believe in. I gave it up to, you could say God, you could say, in the book I call Jesus whatever, Clem or Ned or something like that. You call him whatever you want. Yeah. There's a spirit out there that's larger than us, and it's everywhere, and its presence is profound.
You took something that happened on the BMT unit, and you turned it into a very, very touching song that is available on the e-book when you download it. It's called Letter from 10 Green. It was a couple in a nearby room that you heard crying, and then you found out their 4-year-old daughter had died. Let's take a listen to this song.
I hear footsteps in the hall. It's 4 a.m., ignore the nurse's call. Little girl has died tonight. She struggled with this disease her entire life. Don't let me hear her mother's cries. Instead, I turn on the light and to my own children I write. Live with all your guts and soul and heart every day.
That's Detroit singer-songwriter and now author Stuart Frankie. We've been talking with him about his memoir, What Don't Kill Me Makes Me Strong. What words of, I guess the word of advice is all I can think of, would you share with people who are fighting their own crisis battle right now? Maybe it's cancer or some other ailment, and also to those who love them?
Well, those are two distinct different things, because sometimes the caretaker's role is just as difficult, if not more difficult, than the patient's. It's very fatiguing, very difficult. But to the patients, I'd say find something to believe in, find something to hold on to, because you can be in the most dire. I've seen the most dire situations that people have come out of and restored their health and gone on to live X amount of years and are still living. And to the caregivers, it's the same thing. You have to find something to believe in, something to hold on to, something larger than ourselves, something, or it can be something real, something tangible, something, you know, just, but it has to be outside yourself a little bit. And man, I've just seen remarkable things in the human spirit from caregivers and people hanging there, particularly with children with cancer. And now, happily, you know, survival rates are up in the 90% with childhood leukemia. And so there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic about leukemia, lymphoma, and things like that.
And I know you've set up the Stuart Frankie Leukemia Foundation and been very busy in Michigan helping to further the battle. We do have to change gears before we let you go and hear some more of your music. And this is also a track available when you buy Stuart's ebook. It's called Summer Soldier. Holler if you if you hear me. Talk to us about that backup singer. It's a pretty familiar voice singing backup.
You know. I did him a favor. Thought I might expose him to a larger audience.
All right, so tell everybody who they're going to hear.
It was a really great experience. It's Bruce Springsteen sang backup on this song. And we had met a few times at the Palace at backstage. And so I just asked straight away. I just asked straight away through his management. I didn't go through friends that we both knew or anything like that. And he replied in the affirmative. And pretty soon we got the files with his voice on it. We were like, my engineer and I were like little kids in a candy shop running around. You know, that's really Bruce. That's his voice. And so it turned out cool. It turned out really cool. And it was a very gracious thing of him to do.
The ebook is What Don't Kill Me Just Makes Me Stronger. Stuart Frankie, thank you so much and continued good health and happiness.
Thank you, Cynthia.
If you hear me, if you hear me, if you hear me, if you hear me, as I lay dying in this wasteland.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our show today was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Stateside was engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Riley Linebaugh, Claire Tennisketter, Katie Suha, and John K. Wilson. This program's a production of Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.